house. Finally, Anze Sturba wrapped Hermann Weinbach's gray body in their bedclothes, and he carried his friend out into the frozen winter. Baby flitted around Anze Sturba and lit on his collar or atop his head as the boy toiled at digging Hermann Weinbach's grave. All the while, the bird sang out about how much Hermann loved Anze and vice versa. Baby said things that were sexual and suggestive, too. Things the boys sometimes said to each other openly in the solitude of their squatter's home. Anze Sturba was like me in many ways. He was confused and troubled by things, and he loved his friend as much as it was possible to love anyone. But there were those things that set Anze Sturba apart from me, too. This is what happened. Anze knew he had to leave Midvale after he buried Hermann Weinbach on the old farm. Maybe it was that he was crazy with grief. I believe that is the truth. Anze knew he could not keep Baby with him any longer. Baby said too many things that could make problems for a young man in Iowa in 1934. Anze Sturba was 18 years old in 1934. Anze Sturba killed his bird and left the farmhouse in Midvale, Iowa, on the same evening he buried Hermann Weinbach's body in a ruined cornfield. That spring, Anze Sturba found himself in Iowa City. He was still greatly tormented over the things he had done with Hermann Weinbach and about losing everything he had ever loved. Anze Sturba needed to prove something to himself. In this way, he was very much like me. He found a job cleaning up at a butcher's shop. There, Anze met a young woman named Phoebe Hildebrandt. Phoebe Hildebrandt was plain and uninteresting at 17 years of age. Her father was the butcher who had hired Anze to clean. They knew my great-grandfather as Andrew Zerba. Phoebe Hildebrandt and her father, whose name was Edmund, both took pity on Andrew because of his age, the softness of his features, and how quiet and sad the boy was. They never knew anything about Andrew's love for a boy named Hermann Weinbach. Andrew Zerba, whose Polish name was my name, Anze, also had bags under his eyes. Anze means man in Polish boy names. One night in June, Anze Sturba and Phoebe Hildebrandt went for a walk. Anze forced himself sexually onto Phoebe. Phoebe Hildebrandt did not resist his advances. Phoebe cried. Sexual intercourse was painful. She lay on her back in the dirt, wondering how long it would take for him to finish. But she also allowed Anze Sturba to insert his erect penis into her vagina. The act hurt Phoebe Hildebrandt, who was a virgin. Anze Sturba wanted to find something out about himself, which he did. He found out he thought only about Hermann Weinbach while he engaged in sexual intercourse with Phoebe Hildebrandt. Afterward, Anze Sturba was disgusted in himself, and he was disgusted by Phoebe and her uninteresting personality, too. But Anze Sturba's semen found its way deep into Phoebe Hildebrandt's body from that unloving sexual act in June of 1934, outside a place called Iowa City, Iowa. Phoebe Hildebrandt was my great-grandmother. In 1935, a boy named Felix Sturba was born. This happened only 2 months after Anze and Phoebe were married. Anze Sturba never put his penis inside Phoebe Hildebrandt again after that first time beside a dirt road in Iowa City. And that was our day. You know what I mean. Anze loved Felix, his son, as much as he had ever loved anything, but Anze Sturba was very unhappy. Felix means lucky in Polish boy names. Felix Sturba's American name was Felix Zerba. Felix Zerba was my grandfather. Movie night in Eden. The theater in Eden had half as many seats as the Cinezar in Waterloo. It was comfortable and clean. Like everything in Eden, the theater sat unused, brand new, and at the same time, it had been preserved like some kind of fossil. This was where we learned the most about the history of McKeon Industries, and about the things that started happening up above us in Ealing after the unfortunate coincidence of Tyler Jacobson dropping the globe of contained MI plague strain 412E directly onto Robbie Breeze's blood. The screen of the Eden Czar was a bit smaller than the screen in Waterloo. The projector sat on a stand, atop a raised platform behind the rows of crushed velvet seats. But all things considered, it was one of the nicer movie venues in this part of Iowa. Growing up, Robbie Breeze had always been projector monitor in our classes at Curtis Crane Lutheran Academy. He knew everything about how to operate a 16mm film projector. It took no effort to get him to volunteer to see what had been left behind in Eden for our viewing pleasure. As he searched through the cabinets behind us, Shan and I took seats in the back row. I slid my hand into the warm spot between Shan's thighs. I said, "Eden 5 needs you." Shan said, "Eden 5 has to wait until Eden 5 grows up." Robbie held up a big steel canister of film and told us the movie inside was called Five Easy Pieces. I thought it was a funny name, especially since I was Eden 5. I was waiting, too. I thought I was grown up. I wished Shan would ask me to go back to one of the dorm rooms with her while Robbie experimented with the projector. Never heard of it, I said. It's from 1970, and it's probably the greatest movie ever made, Robbie answered. Robbie missed being born at the right time by about 4 decades. My father, Eric Andrew Zerba, was 10 years old in 1970. Eric Andrew Zerba's Polish name would be Arik Andrzej Szczerba. His father, Felek, who everyone called Felix, was 35 when Five Easy Pieces was made. You should have been alive in the 70s, Rob, I said.
Hell yes, Robbie affirmed.
We did not watch Five Easy Pieces that night. Robbie found another stack of canisters that were labeled Eden Orientation Series. It felt like we were being indoctrinated into an army or some shit like that. And I hoped it was an army for repopulating the planet, so it made me very horny to think about my mission down here in Eden with Shan and Robbie. Duty calls, I said. Shan said, huh? I told Robbie it was our duty to get oriented. We owe it to the world, and to history, to watch Eden Orientation Series, Robbie, I pointed out. There were 3 film reels in all. Robbie and I noticed they were numbered 1 of 5, 2 of 5, and 3 of 5. 2 canisters of the 5 films were missing. Robbie also found reels of a film called A Clockwork Orange, but reels 4 and 5 of Eden Orientation Series were nowhere in the theater. That was because those particular reels were up on the roof at Grasshopper Jungle. They were there when we found a plastic flamingo with a steel spike coming out of its ass, a grimacing lemur mask that makes your face stink, and 2 bottles of wine, one of which Robbie and I drank on Monday night in his bedroom at the Del Vista Arms. It took me and Robbie a while to figure that part out. Not too long, though. We were probably a little more intelligent than most cave people. You know what I mean. Robbie Breeze fed the leader of Reel 1 into the projector, and a grainy numbered countdown squiggled and danced on the screen in front of us. Robbie hopped over the seats and sat beside me. I was in the middle of Shan and Robbie. I was always in the middle of them. It made me feel horny and awkward, too. Most boys would have sat next to Shan. Boys from Curtis Crane Lutheran Academy would never sit without an empty seat between them and a movie theater. That's what Lutheran boys do. They project their fear of being thought of as homosexuals, so they do uncomfortable things like sit with empty seats between them, and then end up wondering if they or their friend on the other side of their sexual buffer zone might be curious about being gay. The uptight straight kid Lutheran boy code of conduct mandates the maintenance of the empty seat between boys in a movie theater, so you don't get any funny ideas about your friend, and nobody looking at you will think you're queer either. Lutheran boys in Iowa know those rules and follow them like lemmings on a springtime jog. But not Robbie Breeze. He sat so close to me, our knees rubbed against each other. Shan knew Robbie was in love with me. How could she not know it? She probably knew I loved Robbie, too. I said it when we danced, after all, and I meant it. Shan definitely knew I was in love with her, too. What was I going to do? I felt nervous and guilty when Shan held my hand, and Robbie's knee pressed so comfortably against mine.
I wonder if they have any popcorn in the cafeteria, Shan said.
Or ice cream, Robbie added. He touched my hand with his fingers. It electrified me. Call the roller of big cigars, I said. That was the first line from my favorite poem, The Emperor of Ice Cream. The line sounded so sexually suggestive. It was like something Hermann Weinbach might have said to his lover, Andrzej Szczerba. I felt myself turning a brilliant heated red. The film sound came on just then, and there was the face of Dr. Grady McKeon. The Good Doctor Accounts for History. Dr. Grady McKeon looked like an old movie star. Well, he looked like an old movie star with a slight twitch in his right eye, which was magnified through the thick lenses of his black framed glasses. Dr. Grady McKeon looked like an old movie star with a psychopath's twitch in his eye. He looked calm and reassuring, how you might imagine a serial killer to look at you while he was sharpening his knives and discussing which parts of your body produced the best tasting sausage meat. Dr. Grady McKeon also had a very small L-shaped scar between his eyebrows. When he was 12 years old, Grady McKeon was struck in the head by an unoccupied wooden swing. The swing was unoccupied because he had just pushed his younger sister, whose name was Arlene, onto her face. Grady McKeon did not want his sister to be on the swing. Arlene was not very talented when it came to sitting on things like bench seats on swings. In 1974, she fell from a ski lift in Jackson Hole and died. Jackson Hole is in Wyoming. Arlene was a real dynamo on snow skis. Not so much on ski lifts. Dr. Grady McKeon was comfortable narrating the filmed history of his life's accomplishments. Grady McKeon's hair was perfect,
He carried a strong resemblance to Shan's stepfather, Johnny McKeon, who was Grady McKeon's decades younger and immensely less talented brother. Also, Grady McKeon had never physically abused Johnny the way he had inflicted harm on their sister, Arlene. Arlene McKeon was also Miss Iowa in 1969. Iowans love shapely young women with names that have lots of long rhyming vowels, even if their brothers are psychopaths. The film was in black and white, but I feel safe making the claim that Dr. Grady McKeon's hair was the color of Smith Brothers licorice cough drops, and his skin was the same color as French vanilla non-dairy creamer. Dr. Grady McKeon wore a blue and white Eden jumpsuit, too. His jumpsuit was monogrammed, the same way a doctor's smock at a hospital would be. The monogram said, Dr. Grady, Eden, 1. Reel 1 opened with Dr. Grady McKeon's personal message to the audience. It was a frighteningly sober introduction, despite the fact that Dr. Grady McKeon maintained a comforting butcher's smile while he spoke. Dr. Grady McKeon looked like he was floating on a fistful of little blue kayaks. He could have easily been sitting across from us at a desk, selling us his top-of-the-line casket for our departed loved ones. Whoever that might be. After his introduction, the film went through a history of McKeon Industries from its founding in 1957 through 1971, which was the year the Eden Orientation Series films were produced. In 1971, a film called The French Connection won the Academy Award for Best Picture. Voting members of the Academy probably did not get a chance to see Eden Orientation Series. This is exactly what Dr. Grady McKeon said at the beginning of his film. Welcome to the Eden Project, my friends. Welcome, welcome. If there are any McKeon family members in the audience, would you please stand and make your presence known? This is where Dr. Grady McKeon smiled and nodded and panned his head from one side of the screen to the other, as though he could somehow look out at us from his black and white celluloid universe. Stand up, Shan, I said.
Stand up, Robbie urged. This is so dumb, Shan said.
Shan stood up. Robbie and I clapped for her. Shan said,
Shut up.
Then Dr. Grady McKeon nodded and continued. Thank you. Each of you is fortunate to be part of the Eden Project. You are fortunate to have survived, but you also bear a tremendous responsibility to mankind. You must breed, my friends. You must breed. You heard the man, I blurted out. Shan said,
Shh.
Dr. Grady McKeon seemed to pause, anticipating the instructions he delivered might cause nervous comments among his audience. Robbie said, and Grady McKeon continued. The event that brought you here today was one of two things. First, if there has been nuclear fallout detected in the atmosphere, you would have been directed into the showers upon arrival. The world above is no longer habitable. You will be alerted as to when it will be appropriate to return to the surface. Until that time, this is the new world, my friends. And you are all the new men and women. The men and women of the future. You have a responsibility to breed. Do not despair. I was not despairing. Here, Dr. Grady McKeon looked very serious and clinical. The camera zoomed in so Dr. Grady McKeon's face occupied the entire screen. Grady McKeon's twitching right eyeball was as big as an Ozark watermelon. Dr. Grady McKeon stared directly out from the screen with the same expression a doctor performing a physical gets just as he grabs your balls and tells you to cough. When a doctor grabs your balls, how can you think about coughing? Coughing when someone is grabbing your balls requires as much concentration as riding a unicycle while carrying an Ozark watermelon. History shows that when your balls are being grabbed, you can only think about your balls and nothing else. See? I told you that's why we're here, I said. Eden 5 needs us. Shan pointed out that there was no nuclear war taking place at the moment.
Nobody's dropped any bombs, Shan said.
It was something of a disappointment to me. Oh, I said. Robbie said, Then Dr. Grady McKeon went on. Second, in the event of a 412E alert, the world above ground will unfortunately become an interspecies battlefield, tremendously dangerous for human beings. You must pay close attention to all the training films we have prepared. Your survival and the future of humanity depend on this. Pay attention and breed, my friends. Breed. If the flamingo at the entry chamber did not activate a warning signal upon your arrival, then you are all safe and free from 412E contamination. Make note, if the 412E event is more than 24 hours into its cycle, you must not return to the surface unless you have prepared the appropriate tools. You will be instructed, my friends. This is your new world, and you are the new race. You are unstoppable. Please do not despair, my friends. I think you will enjoy living in this most remarkable world. Live in love. Live in love. Eden is love, my friends. In Eden, a new human race will begin. It is your duty to do this. You will find the Eden Project compound to have sufficient resources for years, perhaps decades. You must prepare to recapture the world from the Mantid armies above. If you have arrived within the window of infestation, then you may be able to halt what will invariably be the end of the world. But you must act. Pay careful attention, my friends. Pay careful attention and breed. Then Dr. Grady McKeon smiled a very creepy smile, like he was imagining pornos from Eden. I happen to be imagining pornos from Eden, too, and they involved the three of us, me, Shan, and Robbie. The introduction shot lap-dissolved into old newsreel clips that took us through the history of Ealing, Iowa, and its most notorious scientist, Dr. Grady McKeon, founder of McKeon Industries. Robbie said,
"What a fucking psycho."
Robbie and I never dropped F-bombs. Obviously, he was as impacted by Dr. Grady McKeon as I was, even if I did appreciate the frequent directive to have sex down there in our new world. Shan squirmed in her seat. She said,
Am I wrong about something? Or do you two boys actually know something more than I do about what he's talking about?
I said, Robbie said, Unstoppable corn. Unstoppable corn. All roads intersected at our feet. We watched the first three reels of Eden Orientation Series. This is what we learned. Dr. Grady McKeon's original business venture, which he founded in Ealing, Iowa in 1957, which was the same year that his little baby brother Johnny came into the world, initially developed fertilizers aimed at increasing corn yields. At that time, McKeon Industries had a workforce of three scientists, one secretary, and a man who drove packages in his pickup truck and swept the floors of the old service station Grady McKeon had taken out on lease. The fertilizer produced was a tremendous hit throughout the Corn Belt, and McKeon Industries expanded rapidly. In 1961, which was the year after my father, Eric Andrew Zerba, was born, McKeon Industries moved into its main plant, the one that recently shut down in Ealing. At the new facility, Dr. Grady McKeon unveiled the redesigned company symbol. The Great Seal of McKeon Industries looked like something you might find in an Ayn Rand novel. Ayn Rand was an author who had no books at all on the shelves of Dr. Grady McKeon's library in Eden. The new symbol for McKeon Industries depicted a gigantic woman, sitting calmly with her legs folded beneath her, apparently gazing out from her 200-foot-high face upon the beautiful and fruitful fields of Iowa. She had an expression like she had just swallowed some blue kayaks. They would have naturally been full-sized kayaks, since the woman was as tall as an oil derrick. Arranged before her bare knees, she was wearing a modestly styled dress that adequately covered her perfect thighs, like a child's toys at Christmas, were hand-sized factories with smokestacks, a gleaming and modern steel locomotive, and for whatever reason, a trio of bare-chested men in overalls working behind what looked like yoked teams of oxen. Ahead of the unnaturally enormous woman, perfect rows of sequoia-sized corn stalks grew, stretching off forever into the Iowa horizon. And inscribed around the curving edge at the bottom of the McKeon seal were the words, Infinita frumenta. Infinita frumenta. Infinita frumenta is Latin for unstoppable corn, or some shit like that. You could pretty much put anything you wanted to in Latin at the bottom of a picture, and people in Iowa would either beat you up, or think you were a messenger from God. Dr. Grady McKeon believed he was God. He preached the gospel of Infinita frumenta. History provides evidence that Infinita frumenta made Dr. Grady McKeon one of the Cold War's largest profiteers. His success entirely resulted from an accident of nature. In Reel 2 of Eden Orientation Series, Dr. Grady McKeon narrated from off-camera as we saw clips of hard-working scientists in perfectly clean white lab coats, while they peered into microscopes and tilted their cigarettes with smirking intelligence, and engaged in academic discussions with one another. Scientists loved a good smoke back in the 1960s. There were also ashtrays built into the armrests of the Eden Theater. When Robbie and I saw those smart, hardworking scientists lighting up their fags, we couldn't resist the urge to join them. It was our duty to smoke along with the Eden Orientation Series.
Ah,
I said after I took a drag.
Ah,
Robbie said. In the 1960s, Infinita frumenta meant that McKeon Industries was working toward the development of corn plants that could not be eaten by insects. Unstoppable corn. Like smoking cigarettes on the job, they probably thought unstoppable corn was a good idea at the time. Scientists working for Dr. Grady McKeon experimented with corn. I know that's an oddly funny thing to say, and I may have to strike that line from my history book, but that's what they did. They experimented with corn. Scientists at McKeon Industries, like Robbie Breeze and I, had no idea what the results of their experiment would be, but they did it anyway. Dr. Grady McKeon and his colleagues attempted to blend genetic material from the semen of grasshoppers into the pollen from corn plants. Pollen is plant sperm. It was not a good idea. The corn they produced from their plant sperm and grasshopper semen experiment was lively and strong. It was also true that, as hoped, bugs would not eat it. It was unstoppable. Dr. Grady McKeon was very happy. His company's stock was worth an incalculable fortune. Fortune is also an odd word. Unfortunately, the corn that was produced by the plant sperm and grasshopper semen experiment at McKeon Industries also caused an undesirable side effect in teenage boys. Their balls dissolved. Testicular dissolution among developing adolescent males is how Dr. Grady McKeon described it. That sounded nicer. If a doctor told me, "You are merely experiencing testicular dissolution," it would not frighten me nearly as much as if he said, "Your balls are going to dissolve, Austin." Actually, the scientists from McKeon Industries at first concluded that their unstoppable corn only caused boys undergoing puberty to have their balls dissolve. That was because the slightest amount of unstoppable corn affected adolescent boys that way. Ultimately, it was discovered that unstoppable corn would pretty much dissolve anyone's balls if you ate enough of it, and if you also had balls. Enough of it turned out to be about an ear and a half. The corn that was harvested in all the McKeon farms across Iowa that year was shipped as a goodwill gesture from the United States of America to the people of Canada. That was the end of Reel 2. Robbie and I both squirmed at the thought of eating some of the McKeon plant sperm and grasshopper semen corn. We also felt sorry for Canada.
"I am never eating anything with corn in it again," Robbie said. "Do they even make food that doesn't have corn in it in Iowa?" Shan asked.
Robbie said. I wondered, did Dr. Grady McKeon ever get married?
"It seems like he probably practiced breeding a lot," Robbie said. "He was never married," Shan answered.
"Maybe he ate some of his own corn," I suggested.
"I need a cigarette," Robbie said.
We found out later that Dr. Grady McKeon indeed did not eat his own corn and experienced testicular dissolution. You will see. Infinita frumenta. Infinita frumenta. 3 of 5. Reel 3, which was the final part of the film we saw that night, ended on a cliffhanger. Dr. Grady McKeon's Eden Orientation Series Part 3 was a true corker. At the end of it, all I could say at first was, "Holy shit." Robbie said,
"Holy shit."
Here is what happened in Reel 3. Fortunately for Dr. Grady McKeon and his company, it turned out that during the 1960s, anything that could look like corn and make your balls dissolve was of tremendous interest to the Department of Defense. McKeon Industries received its first of many lucrative contracts to develop unstoppable weapons and, later, unstoppable soldiers. That was how the 6-foot-tall, tooth-armed mantises that were more powerful than grizzly bears came about. But that was through an accident of nature, too. By 1965, McKeon Industries employed 2,700 people in Ealing, Iowa. In 1965, Ealing, Iowa was a Cold War boomtown. That year, my father, Eric Andrew Zerba, who had been baptized in the Catholic Church, enrolled in kindergarten. After the mishap with the grasshopper semen and plant sperm experiment, McKeon Industries went to work on a variety of theoretical methods aimed at stopping the global spread of communism. There were multiple units within the scientific department at McKeon Industries, each of which was developing its own creative anti-communist ideas. One of the units worked with the unstoppable corn material. In that particular lab, scientists attempted to invent some type of delivery system that would result in the testicular dissolution of enemy armies. Nobody would ever take an army of communists without balls seriously. Another of the units worked on a human replication project. It was a first attempt to actually clone soldiers. That was where the human head, penis, and the praying hands in the jars came from. Robbie and I found those when we broke into Johnny McKeon's office the night we climbed up on the roof at Grasshopper Jungle. The human replication unit was also where the little two-headed boy was created. We found this out later. Reel 3 of Eden Orientation Series involved Robbie and me in ways we never anticipated. This was how it happened. The film showed how the Unstoppable Corn Lab team had been extracting cellular material from crop yields that had been stored in a silo on one of the remaining McKeon Industries Unstoppable Corn Farms. Their goal was to dissolve Russian balls around the world. Later, I did find out by researching archived records in Eden that President Richard Nixon also brought some of Dr. Grady McKeon's unstoppable corn to China as a gift. In what was called Eden's Brain Room, I discovered a black-and-white photograph that showed the Prime Minister of China, a man whose name was Chou Enlai, eating some of Dr. Grady McKeon's unstoppable corn while the President of the United States of America looked on and smiled warmly. Prime Minister Chou Enlai's balls dissolved. When the Unstoppable Corn team began offloading silos of unstoppable corn in Iowa, they discovered the corn, when decaying, produced a new variety of mold that they had never seen before. They had never seen it before because the mold was an accident of nature. The mold gave off a blue photoluminescent glow. This second accident of nature became known as Plague Strain 412E. There was no significance to the 412E part of the name. The marketing division of McKeon Industries believed the name sounded good for a sales pitch to the Defense Department, as though it came about after hundreds of trials and tests. In reality, 412E was just an accident of nature that occurred when scientists attempted to splice together the genetic material from grasshopper semen with plant sperm and fertilize corn with it. Scientists at McKeon Industries took the mold into their labs, where they grew great heaps of the stuff inside long glass boxes that looked like massive aquariums. They didn't know what to do with the mold, but they were fascinated by the sponge-like form of the mold and how it moved and pulsated and gave off light. Despite seeing it in the black-and-white film, Robbie and I recognized the familiar glow of the 412E mold when the camera captured its luminescence after the scientists in the film turned off the laboratory's lights. Dr. Grady McKeon, the film's narrator, said this, "Behold the wondrous glow of a new being." I said, "Huh." Shan said,
"He's a little overly impressed by something that looks like rotten cauliflower." "That's the same shit Johnny had in his office," Robbie said.
"What is?"
Shan asked.
"That shit," I said.
Robbie added,
Yeah.
Robbie Breeze and I had some explaining to do. "Your stepfather," I said. "He had some of that stuff inside his office at From Attic to Cellar consignment store. Robbie and I saw it."
"When were you inside Johnny's office?" Shan asked.
"Shh," Robbie said, playing the part of the irritated moviegoer who was distracted by talkers in the theater.
"Be quiet and listen to the film."
Here was where Eden Orientation Series turned into a horror show. It turned into a horror show for two reasons. First, the scientists who were working on the Unstoppable Corn / Unstoppable Soldier project decided to try mixing the genetic material from the mold with a fresh sample of human blood. They decided to use Dr. Grady McKeon's own blood. Dr. Grady McKeon thought of himself as a kind of god, so he drew his own blood to mix with the genetic material from the photoluminescent mold. It was not a good idea. The idea to mix human blood material with the 412E mold was even less reasonable than laboratory scientists deciding it was a good idea to smoke on the job and screw around with grasshopper semen by grafting it into plant sperm and injecting it into corn seeds. Dr. Grady McKeon's blood made the 412E mold very happy. Here was the beginning of the end of the world, and it took place in the 1960s. "This is the shit that was drawn on the blackboard in the lecture hall," I said.
"Huh?"
Shan said. Robbie said,
"Uh-oh."
It was all starting to come together. The roads were intersecting, but it got worse, too. I said,
"Robbie, hop back there and freeze the film on that part."
Robbie, who was our projector monitor, said,
"What?"
I said, "Back up to that part where the scientist is adding blood to the petri dish and stop it on that frame." Robbie did what I asked him to do. And here was the second reason Eden Orientation Series truly turned into a horror show right before my eyes. The scientist who was feeding the human blood to host 412E, who also happened to be starting an initial infestation event, looked exactly like my father, Eric Andrew Zerba. Of course, the scientist in the film could not be my father because Eric Andrew Zerba would have been a kindergartner at exactly the same time that portion of the film was shot.
"Hey, Porcupine," Robbie said. "That guy looks exactly like your dad."
I said, "Huh." Shan agreed.
"He does look exactly like your dad, Austin."
The film was grainy, but we all could see how the scientist's lab coat had been monogrammed with a name. Felix Zerba. It was my grandfather, Felix Zerba, whose father, like me, had been born with the name Unze. Felix Zerba, whose American name was Felix Zerba, was the first victim of McKeon Industries' plague strain 412E. Nobody knew anything about it. They sure found out fast, though. As we let the film play through, Dr. Grady McKeon's voice spoke over a series of frozen pictures. The pictures showed the faces of the scientists and secretaries who worked with Felix Zerba at McKeon Industries. Dr. Grady McKeon explained how these brave patriots lost their lives while developing an unstoppable soldier to fight against communism. Unfortunately, the unstoppable soldiers McKeon Industries created were nothing more than accidents of nature, resembling six-foot-tall praying mantises with lightning-fast arms that were studded with rows and rows of needle-sharp, barbed teeth. Unstoppable soldiers liked doing only two things, fucking and eating. They were also nearly impossible to stop. Dr. Grady McKeon said that, through research, scientists at McKeon Industries did find one way to stop his unstoppable soldiers. And that was exactly when Reel 3 of 5 ended. "We need to go back," I said. Robbie said, Shan said,
"Back where?"
"We need to go back to Grasshopper Jungle. Robbie and I need to go back up on the roof. We left something there," I said.
"What did you two leave up there?"
Shan said. I could have said a lot of things about what Robbie Breeze and I left behind up on the roof of Grasshopper Jungle. I said, "The rest of the film is up there. Shan, we need to see the rest of this film." Shan said,
"Oh."
And Robbie said,
"And I think we need to hurry."
The Orphan Felix. Felix Sturba was 9 years old when his father was killed. It happened at a place called Cisterna. Cisterna is in Italy. Unze Zerba had joined the United States Army in 1942. He enlisted in the army because he wanted to fight against Hitler, and because he was so unhappy living in Iowa with Phoebe Hildebrandt. Unze Sturba was homosexual, but nobody knew anything about that. The only person who ever knew about Unze Sturba's homosexuality was Hermann Weinbach. Hermann Weinbach died from pneumonia in Midvale, Iowa in 1934. Unze Sturba never got to meet Hermann Weinbach's uncle, a man named Bruno Weiner, who performed with Bruno's Amazing and Incredible Dogs with a circus in California. In the summer of 1944, Unze Sturba was shot through the back of his head while he was crouching down to take a shit in a little place called Cisterna, Italy. He received a medal for getting killed while shitting. Unze Sturba's great-grandson, Eric Christopher Zerba, also received a medal for having his balls torn off by an unstoppable homemade bomb. Dulce et decorum est. Felix Zerba was very intelligent. He graduated from high school in Iowa City at the age of 14. His mother, Phoebe Hildebrandt, remarried when Felix was 10 years old. Phoebe Hildebrandt began having sexual intercourse after the long, lonely spell that followed the time Unze Sturba stole her virginity and gave her his son, Felix. Phoebe Hildebrandt hated Felix's name. Against Felix's will, Phoebe Hildebrandt had her new husband, whose name was Daniel Barton, adopt the boy and change his name to Felix Barton. It is a little-known fact of history that I was nearly named Austin Barton, a name that has the kind of ringing sound Iowans appreciate. Daniel Barton owned a radio station in Iowa City. He was 52 years old when he married Phoebe Hildebrandt in 1945. Daniel Barton also had defective semen. He had a low sperm count, but Daniel Barton never knew anything about it. He never knew because his wife, Phoebe, became pregnant 3 times from 3 different men before Felix graduated from high school. Daniel Barton was convinced he had very powerful sperm. Phoebe Barton was a real dynamo at having sexual intercourse with numerous men in Iowa City. Phoebe Barton was unstoppable. She liked doing exactly the same 2 things that bugs like to do. Phoebe Barton never knew how much she would enjoy sexual intercourse until Unze Sturba was shot in the head while taking a shit. Before that, Phoebe only believed that sexual intercourse was painful, interminably long, and sad, and that it would make you bleed. Phoebe Barton's 3 new children, a boy named Eldon Wayne and 2 girls, Chastity and Linda, were presumed by everyone to be full-blooded Bartons. Daniel Barton believed it too. Phoebe Barton's youngest daughter, whose name was Linda, was a product of semen that was produced in the testicles of Felix's high school physics teacher. After Felix Barton, whose real name was Felix Sturba but was called Felix Zerba by American people, graduated high school at the very young age of 14, Daniel Barton and his wife, Phoebe, enrolled the boy into Stanford University. Stanford University is in a place called Palo Alto, California. Palo Alto means tall stick in Spanish. There are big trees near Stanford University. Spanish missionaries were real good at naming shit. Felix Barton was very lonely and unhappy in California. At Stanford, Felix tried to kill himself once by mixing chemicals that created a poisonous cloud of gas. It was not a good idea. Felix Barton only ended up burning the lining of his airways. As a result, Felix Barton, who had been born Felix Gerba, had a chronic cough for the rest of his life. After he graduated the university, Felix had his name legally changed back to Felix Unzés Gerba. He sometimes went by Felix Zerba, because Americans get so uptight about all those bunched-up consonants and shit like that. Felix married a Catholic Polish girl he met in California. His wife was named Ksenia. She was very beautiful. Ksenia Gerba was my grandmother. Unlike his adoptive father, Daniel Barton, Felix Gerba did not have any problems at all with his sperm. In 1960, when Felix was 25 years old, his first son, Eric Unzés Gerba, was born. Eric Unzés Gerba was my father, Eric Zerba. Felix and Ksenia Gerba had four more strong Polish sons together. Their names were Krzyś, Mieszko, Gabriel, and Jacek. In 1965, Felix Gerba and his family moved back to Iowa, to Ealing, where Felix accepted a position in the research laboratories at McKean Industries. In 1968, Felix Gerba was killed in a motorcycle accident. The history recorded in the Waterloo paper described how Felix Gerba apparently lost control of his motorcycle and ran himself beneath the wheels of a freight car that was carrying liquid fertilizer. The fertilizer was made in Ealing, Iowa. What actually happened to Felix Unzés Gerba that day was this. Felix Unzés Gerba hatched out. Felix means lucky. Felix Gerba was the first unstoppable soldier. Part 4. The End of the World. St. Kazimierz was not an unstoppable soldier. When he was a teenager, his father ordered Kazimierz to lead the army of Poland to conquer Hungary. Some Catholic scholars claim Kazimierz refused to do it. They say Kazimierz did not refuse because he was afraid. Kazimierz refused because he thought it was unjust to go to war against Hungary. Some historians claim Kazimierz, who was only 13 at the time, went to war, but was defeated. Hungarians may have masturbated less often than Polish boys. This is probably true. Kazimierz's father punished him for not going to war. It is difficult to imagine how you could punish a boy for not going to war. It is kind of like punishing a boy for skipping dinner by giving him cake. In order to resist sexual temptation, Kazimierz wore a hair shirt, which was something coarse and irritating that was made from goat's hair. Devout people like Kazimierz would wear this garment as underwear so it would rub against their skin. The only purpose of a hair shirt is to cause injury and pain. Some historians claim that St. Kazimierz may have worn his hair shirt in direct contact with his penis. Hair shirts work like dynamos. Nobody makes hair shirts nowadays. We, the new humans. I told Shan Collins everything that night. I told her about what happened at Grasshopper Jungle. I said Grant Wallace and the Hoover Boys had broken into the place looking for alcohol, and that Robbie Breeze and I should not have been there, but we were. I told Shan Collins what we found inside Johnny McKeon's office, and how Tyler Jacobson dropped the glass universe and splattered what we knew was 412E all over the alley behind From Attic to Cellar consignment store. This is what I said to Shan Collins. Robbie Breeze drove me out to Waterloo so we could look into the future. We went to the Tally Ho, where a homeless man we called Hungry Jack stepped in front of the path of a speeding Dodge truck, and then this horrible creature hatched out of his body and ate him. Shan had to go home. It was late. Shan changed out of her Eden Project jumpsuit. She could not go home dressed in a strange uniform. Wendy McKeon, Shan Collins's mother, was one of those types of mothers who paid attention to things like what their children were wearing when they left the house. Wendy McKeon would ask questions, and we did not want anyone to know about Shan's silo. Nobody knew anything at all about Eden. Robbie Breeze and I kept our Eden Project jumpsuits on. We left all our clothes, except for our shoes, down inside the silo. Wearing the jumpsuits made us feel like we were an army or something. It made us feel like we belonged together. Anyway, Robbie Breeze and I had some shit to do. Nobody would ever know if Robbie and I didn't go home that night. It was 8:30. Shan had missed dinner with her family. Her cell phone hadn't worked when we were down inside Eden. She was going to be in trouble. Good Lutheran kids in Iowa do not forget to come home for dinner with their families. Coming up out of Eden under a big, black, star-filled Iowa sky made us feel like we were climbing from a spaceship and onto the surface of some alien world. Everything was different. We were the new humans. That was exactly what Dr. Grady McKeon told us we were. Robbie waited for me in his old Ford Explorer, so I could walk Shan to the front door of the McKeon house. I asked her if she wanted me to say something to her mom or to Johnny McKeon, but Shan said no, that she was going to be in trouble and I couldn't possibly make things better. So I hugged Shan. It felt really good squeezing my body against hers in my jumpsuit, like I wasn't wearing anything but my boxers. I kissed her for a long time and ran my hands up and down from her butt to her shoulders. I was trying to get her to accept Dr. Grady McKeon's advice about our mission. I had forgotten all about Robbie waiting in his car and about big monstrous bugs. I pressed my hips into Shan's. That was exactly when Shan whispered,
"I think Robbie is in love with you, Austin."
I felt a lump in my throat, and I asked St. Casimir's to make things okay. I said.
"I can tell he is,"
Shan said. I said, "Is there something wrong with that?" Shan backed away from me a half step. Her eyes tracked up and down all over my body. Jumpsuits are no good for hiding erections. I tried to adjust myself. Shan said,
"Is there something wrong with that? Don't you think there's something wrong with that, Austin?"
I said. I honestly did not think there was anything wrong with Robbie Breeze being in love with me. I was probably wrong about that. Shan said,
"Have you guys ever done anything?"
I felt all the blood draining out from every part of my body. It felt cold and wiggly. "What do you mean? Like skate? We do lots of things," I said. "I do not lie. It is my job not to ever lie." I wanted a cigarette.
"Have you ever kissed Robbie?"
Shan said. I had to tell her. I loved Shan, and I do not lie. Yes, I said.
"Oh," Shan said. "Like, I mean, a real kiss."
"Yes, I did," I said. I looked away. I was suddenly aware that Robbie was waiting. I could hear the clunk, clunk, clunk of the old Ford's engine. Shan backed up against the front door. Then Shan said,
"Have you and Robbie ever had sex with each other?"
I said, "No." I did not lie to her. "Come on, Shan, please," I said. "You know I am totally in love with you." Shan looked as though I'd just kicked her in the stomach. She did not say another word. She went inside and closed the door behind her. I heard the sound of the deadbolt turning within the door's locking mechanism. And that was my day. You know what I mean. What was I going to do? The end of the world was nearly 1 week old. The end of the world was nearly 1 week old, and only three people in Ealing knew about it. Me, Robbie Breeze, and Shan Collins. Last legs. Robbie slid a pack of cigarettes across the top of the dashboard toward me when I climbed into his car. He did not say anything. I did not say anything. Robbie could tell something else had gone wrong. Another something else. Robbie always knew everything about me. I lit a cigarette. The engine clunked and clunked. "This car's on its last legs," I said. Davy Crockett and Daniel Boone never wore coonskin caps. Robbie took me home. I needed to get my history books, and Ingrid, too. I wanted to take Ingrid with us to Eden. Maybe I was crazy with grief. Maybe all the shit, thinking about my brother Eric, my grandfather Felic, and his lost and sad father, Unze, poor Herman Weinbach who loved him, St. Casimir's, Shan Collins, and the talking European starling named Baby. Playing all of those thoughts through the reel-to-reel between my ears made me feel like I was all alone and standing on the edge of a razor blade. Robbie played one of his father's old cassette tapes in the Explorer. We listened to Exile on Main Street. And the car shuddered past Curtis Crane Lutheran Academy, which was located in Ealing, Iowa, on Main Street.
"So, you want to tell me about it, Porcupine?"
Robbie said. I knew what Robbie was talking about. I played dumb anyway. I said,
"Tell you about what, Rob?"
"What happened between you and Shan back there, that's what,"
Robbie said. "Oh," I said, "nothing." History does show that nothing means a hell of a lot more than nothing when teenagers talk. In this case, Robbie knew it meant that I did not want to talk about it, so he left me alone. Robbie Breeze was such a good friend. It was awkwardly quiet inside my empty house with Robbie Breeze that night. It was one of those exceedingly dumb moments where I did not know whether I was supposed to actually say something to him. I felt myself wanting to act like an asshole to Robbie again, so I closed my eyes and asked St. Casimir's to help me shut the hell up. Ingrid came bounding for the door as soon as we were inside. She ran out into the nicely mowed front yard. I left the door standing open, A kind of message to anyone passing by that Robbie Breeze and I were not conducting experiments inside my house while my parents were gone. Robbie knew what I was doing. Leaving the door open like that was the kind of thing an uptight asshole would do. I grabbed my cell phone from the coffee table where it had been sitting all day. I saw that I'd missed a phone call from Eric, my brother. Eric left a message. I sat on the sofa and listened to my brother's voice. Robbie stood by the door and watched me. He knew what was happening. We were soldiers in this together, wearing our grasshopper jungle uniforms. Robbie Breeze and I could be unstoppable too if we told ourselves to be. This is the message Eric left for me on my phone. Hey, Booney, I miss you and I hope you're out having fun and smoking cigarettes and shit like that. I wish you were here instead of Dad and Mom. I'm sorry if I scared you or anything. I'm going to be okay, Booney, I promise. You be okay too. I'll see you soon. When I was 9 years old and Eric was 15, my family took a trip to Nashville, Tennessee. I still do not understand why we went to Nashville, but I do remember that my mother and father enjoyed the trip quite a bit. Because Eric was a teenager, my father and mother would go out at night and listen to music. They felt comfortable leaving my brother and me alone at our hotel. Eric was mature and sensible enough at 15 to take care of me. These days, mothers and fathers end up in jail for doing shit like that. At least you frequently hear terrible stories about what happens to kids left alone in hotel rooms, even if the kids happen to be sensible and mature. While we were in Tennessee, my father bought me a fake coonskin cap, which I wore for so many continuous days and nights I began to develop a bald spot on the back of my scalp. My bald spot was right below the place on the cap where a plastic button had been stitched to the inside in order to secure the fake raccoon tail. The coonskin cap was a souvenir from a place called Crockett Land. The coonskin cap was made in China. Richard M. Nixon, President of the United States of America, brought some unstoppable corn to China in 1972. He used the unstoppable corn to dissolve Prime Minister Chou Enlai's balls. To my knowledge, my fake coonskin cap did not adversely affect my balls. Crockett Land sold souvenirs that cashed in on a man named Davy Crockett, who was a frontiersman from Tennessee. Eric started calling me Booney that summer when I was 9 and he was 15, because he said I looked like Daniel Boone, who was also a frontiersman from Pennsylvania. History shows that neither Davy Crockett nor Daniel Boone ever wore coonskin caps, but movies made people believe they did. Meriwether Lewis wore coonskin caps, however. I was happy my brother did not start calling me Meriwether. I do not know if movies ever showed Meriwether Lewis wearing a coonskin cap. When you think of exciting movies about frontiersmen, you tend to think about Daniel Boone and Davy Crockett, as opposed to some guy named Meriwether. Movies made people believe a lot of shit about history. Robbie Breeze and I believed what we saw in Eden Orientation series. It was the truth. There were two prostitutes who lived in the same hotel in Nashville where we stayed. One night, Eric and I were playing catch with a foam rubber football out on the balcony that connected all the rooms on the third floor, which was the floor our room was on. We said hello to the prostitutes. The prostitutes were named Tiffany and Rhonda. I do not know their last names. History shows that a lot of prostitutes do not necessarily need last names. Tiffany had hair the color of whipped sweet potatoes and skin like creamy hot cocoa. Rhonda had lemon meringue hair and always wore lipstick the color of cotton candy. Eric knew what Tiffany and Rhonda were doing. I thought it was curious how my brother would watch Tiffany and Rhonda come and go and come and go, and how Eric always acted so nice and proper toward them. The girls winked at us both, and sometimes Tiffany, who was quite fat, would comb her hands through Eric's hair and flirt with him suggestively, and rub the back of my neck with her thick, warm fingers. Tiffany and Rhonda were very nice. On the third night, Eric went into Tiffany and Rhonda's room with them. Eric left me alone on the balcony for nearly an hour. It may have been more or less than an hour. When you are 9 years old, 5 minutes can seem like a week, more or less. When he came out of Tiffany and Rhonda's room, Eric looked pale, like he was sick or something. Eric's hair was sweaty around his ears and along the back of his neck, and somehow his t-shirt had been turned backwards and inside out. Eric's eyes were funny too, like he was sleepy and startled at the same time. I asked him why he left me alone, and Eric told me that Tiffany and Rhonda gave him a blowjob. To me, hearing that those girls gave my brother Eric a blowjob sounded very nice. History shows that all boys consider blowjob to be a nice-sounding set of words. I thought a blowjob was putting your face in front of an air conditioner, which is something all 9-year-old boys love to do, even though Eric did not look like he had been cooled off very much. I asked Eric if Tiffany and Rana would give me a blowjob too. Eric laughed and laughed. Then he told me what a blowjob was. Eric lifted up his shirt and showed me how there were perfect kisses of cotton candy lipstick all down below his freckled cream of wheat belly and over both of his nipples. At that time, being 9 years old and dressed in a coonskin cap in Nashville, Tennessee as I was, I could not understand at all why anyone would ever let someone give them a blowjob. I listened to my brother's message a second time. I realized I'd almost forgotten how Eric liked to call me Boonie. Sometimes, when I teased Eric afterward, during that summer when he was 15, I would call him Cotton Candy. And Eric would get embarrassed in front of my mother and father, and tell me to shut up too. While I listened to my brother's voice, a text message came in from Shan Collins. It said this: "You are disgusting." I did not even know that I was sitting there on my sofa in my living room crying. I don't cry. I suppose I was tired, and disappointed too for what I had done to Shan and Robbie, and especially because I missed my brother, and I wanted him to get better, even if I knew nothing would ever be better than it was for Eric and me on those summer nights when we played catch and shit like that, all alone in that hotel in Nashville. Robbie put his hand on my shoulder and shook me. He said,
"Hey, hey, don't do that, Austin."
I wiped my face and told Robbie I was sorry for crying. Then I went back into my room and grabbed my history books. It was a heavy stack. Garlic, Dr. Pepper, and Crystal Meth. We were not heading toward Grasshopper Jungle. I said, "Robbie, where are you going?" Robbie said,
"I need to go to my house. I need to grab some shit too."
Ingrid curled up on the back seat. I reached between Robbie and me and stroked her fur. "You're a good dog, Ingrid," I said. There was something unnaturally still and menacing about the night. Maybe I was only working myself up, getting too emotional. Ealing would always be a ghost town. It just felt like more of a ghost town that night, after Robbie parked the Explorer along the curb in front of the Del Vista Arms. Robbie said,
"You want to come in with me, Austin?"
I said, "I better wait here with Ingrid. You wouldn't want her to shit in your car, or shit like that." Robbie shrugged. We both knew what we were thinking about. Robbie said,
"I'll be right back."
I turned around and patted Ingrid again. I tried not to be nervous about things, but my head was swimming, drowning actually in uncertainty. I unzipped the top of my jumpsuit and played with the St. Casimir's medal that hung from my neck. And then I whispered, "What am I going to do, Ingrid?" Robbie ran around the front of the car and disappeared inside the Del Vista Arms. I thought about Shan Collins, and how she told me I was disgusting. At exactly that moment, Ollie Jungfrau was killing aliens in an online space shooter game. He was sitting up in his bed, in his underwear, with his laptop resting on his thighs. Ollie had eaten a large pizza and drank 5 cans from a 6-pack of Dr. Pepper. Tiny speckles of pizza sauce dotted Ollie's swollen breasts. Ollie Jungfrau needed to piss, but he did not want to get up from bed. He tried to calculate whether he could get away with peeing in his empty Dr. Pepper cans. Ollie Jungfrau decided trying to do that might cut his penis, which he could not actually see due to the roll of his belly, or it might cause him to piss in his own bed. Ollie had pissed in his bed before, when he was too tired to get up and walk to the toilet. Ollie Jungfrau got up. He walked past his window and looked down at the street. Ollie Jungfrau saw Robbie Breeze running around the front of a Ford Explorer parked in front of their apartment building. Ollie hated Robbie Breeze because Robbie was gay, and Ollie knew it, and also because Robbie was so young and good-looking. Ollie wished Robbie Breeze would fall down, trip on the curb or shit like that, but Robbie was also coordinated and balanced. Ollie Jungfrau hated young, good-looking, coordinated kids, especially ones like Robbie Breeze, who were gay. Ollie Jungfrau's eye caught the movement of something farther down the street in the dark. Ollie Jungfrau's eyes were good at noticing quick movements. That was how he killed so many aliens in the game he played every day. The motion Ollie detected was not caused by an alien, however. Ollie Jungfrau saw the dark form of an unstoppable soldier crossing the street ahead of Robbie Breeze's Ford Explorer. He saw the creature just as Robbie disappeared into the foyer at the Del Vista Arms. The unstoppable soldier, a 6-foot-tall mantis thing with spike-studded arms, was Hungry Jack. Hungry Jack was hungry again. I sat inside Robbie Breeze's Ford Explorer. I was turned toward the back seat, stroking Ingrid's fur and flipping the silver St. Casimir's medallion with my left hand. Olli Jungfrau did not know the Polish kid he sold cigarettes to and called Dynamo was down there in the gay kid's car on the street. Olli Jungfrau stood at his window, frozen in fright. He was in his boxers and socks, and he was standing in a puddle of his own steaming piss. Ollie's piss had the slight smell of garlic and Dr. Pepper. And at the same time that Olli Jungfrau was urinating down his bread dough thighs, watching in horror as Hungry Jack scampered like a metal wind-up puppet through the dark toward me and Ingrid while we sat in Robbie's car, Dwayne Coventry, the chemistry teacher from Curtis Crane Lutheran Academy, put down his glass meth pipe after smoking 3 peanut-sized rocks of crystal. Dwayne Coventry sat completely naked at his computer. The chemistry teacher from Curtis Crane Lutheran Academy could look at pornography for endless hours when he smoked meth. The only thing that sometimes interfered with viewing pornography, which frequently lasted until daybreak, was if Dwayne Coventry turned the computer's camera on himself. Then Dwayne Coventry used his monitor as a mirror, so he could study his face, scratch at it, pick spots out of his skin that were not there, until he made them real with his own yellowed fingernails. That was what Dwayne Coventry was doing at the exact moment Olli Jungfrau was pissing himself. And Hungry Jack was click-stepping toward the smell of Robbie Breeze and the food meat things that sat inside Robbie's car. Dwayne Coventry was picking his face, naked, seated at his computer, picking and picking and picking. Dwayne Coventry thought he left his doors and windows open. Dwayne Coventry always had to check his doors and windows whenever he smoked his meth. He stood up, took a step toward the front door of a small Iowa house. Then Dwayne Coventry turned around and grabbed his pipe. He burned the amber residue inside the little glass globe and inhaled deeply. Dwayne Coventry forgot why he'd been standing up. He sat down again and began picking his face. Every night Dwayne Coventry smoked methamphetamine was exactly like this. Nobody knew anything about Dwayne Coventry. Dwayne Coventry wanted to look at pornography and masturbate, but he needed to check his doors and windows. Dwayne believed people were always outside, always watching him. Dwayne Coventry went into his kitchen, where he'd been cooking methamphetamine for over a year without anyone knowing about it. Dwayne Coventry loved methamphetamine more than he could ever love anything else. He checked the door that opened onto the kitchen porch. It was locked. Dwayne Coventry walked through the small living room and checked the windows behind his sofa. The windows were latched secure. Then he checked his front door. The front door had not been closed all the way. Scrawled into the plasterboard wall, all down along both sides of Dwayne Coventry's front door were letters and numbers. They were license plate tags from cars Dwayne Coventry saw outside his house whenever he smoked meth. There were exactly 464 different license plate numbers etched into Dwayne Coventry's living room wall. Dwayne Coventry knew there was always someone out there watching him, waiting for him. When Dwayne Coventry opened the front door, he stepped outside. As soon as Dwayne Coventry went outside his little Iowa house, he strained to think about why he was going out into the night. He had forgotten what he needed to do, but Dwayne Coventry, our chemistry teacher from Curtis Crane Lutheran Academy, did realize he was completely naked. He thought that maybe he was supposed to check to be certain his car doors had been locked. Dwayne Coventry's car was parked in the driveway beside a hedge of rose bushes. Dwayne walked across the yard toward his car. It was not a good idea. Tyler Jacobson and Roger Baird had caught up to the exhausted Eileen Pope, who was trying to find something as big as an empty house or a garage in which to lay her millions of fertilized eggs. Roger Baird had Eileen Pope pinned down. He was fucking her on the lawn just beyond Dwayne Coventry's rose hedge. Roger Baird was doing one of the only two things unstoppable soldiers ever want to do. Eileen Pope was too tired to eat Roger Baird. Tyler Jacobson was tired and hungry. Tyler Jacobson smelled Dwayne Coventry's sweat as soon as the meth smoker opened his front door. Dwayne Coventry looked over the hedge and saw three monstrous things in the grass of his lawn. Dwayne Coventry said, "Big fucking bugs." That is exactly what they were. Tyler Jacobson, Roger Baird, and Eileen Pope were the materialization of a meth smoker's most horrible delusion. Gigantic bugs with jagged bear trap mandibles and folded claw arms prickled with mountain ranges of knife blade triangular teeth. In the last second of his life, Dwayne Coventry felt a sort of jubilant vindication. He had been right after all this time. There really were horrible things waiting to get him outside his house. Dwayne Coventry was right. Tyler Jacobson left little more than a few dime-sized bloodstains from the meal he made of the chemistry teacher from Curtis Crane Lutheran Academy. Tyler Jacobson was unstoppable. And at exactly that moment, Ingrid's ears perked up. If Ingrid were a normal dog that hadn't lost their throat's barking mechanism to cancer, Ingrid would have barked and barked. Ingrid heard and smelled the monster named Hungry Jack as he got right up next to Robbie's old Ford. I scratched Ingrid's ears. I said, "What's wrong, Ingrid?" I turned away from her and I saw the triangular glistening head of the giant bug that stared at me, fascinated, watching me through the windshield of my best friend's car. "Holy shit," I said. I am not certain that is exactly what I said, but I did say something. Sometimes historians need to fill in the blanks on their own. It is part of our job. You trust us because we are historians. Historians are reliable blank fillers. It is my job. Hungry Jack's mandibles yawned open. A gooey string of bug saliva hammocked between his jagged, side-hinged jaws. The mandibles opened and closed, opened and closed. Hungry Jack wanted to eat me and Ingrid. Hungry Jack pressed his head into the windshield of Robbie's Explorer. He tried to bite me through the glass, but he could not figure out what was keeping him from getting me into his mouth. He bit and bit at the windshield, each time leaving streaks of milky bug spit on the glass. Ingrid squeezed her way up between the front seats, into my lap, and also tried to bite Hungry Jack through the unyielding windshield. Bugs are not very smart, but Hungry Jack was persistent. I reached over to the steering column, but Robbie had taken the car keys with him. Of course Robbie would have taken the keys. He would have no way to enter the Del Vista Arms without his keys. I pressed down into the car's horn. Robbie's Ford Explorer was exactly like Ingrid, barkless. The horn did not work. I pushed Ingrid back and scooted my way deeper into the rear cargo compartment of the car. Hungry Jack whipped his arms up and struck them into the windshield. He was figuring out the puzzle. Cracks starred outward from the impact, fracturing the windshield in every direction, all the way to the rubber gasket frame. At exactly that moment, Robbie Breeze stepped out from the foyer at the Del Vista Arms. When I saw Robbie, he was standing on the sidewalk with some objects under one arm, only a few feet away from Hungry Jack. It was not a good idea. "Robbie!" I screamed, but it was too late. Clickety-clickety. The compound eyes on an unstoppable soldier take up approximately 3/4 of his head.